welcome to episode 27 of our podcast called Two Chairs Talking. My name is David Grigg, and my co-host, as always, is Perry Middlemiss. How's things, Perry?
Surviving, David.
Surviving. Any news?
Not really. No, it's
things
sort of...
just roll on, don't they? Is the way
well, when you're in lockdown like this, one day just seems to roll into the next, and it sort of look back on it and you think, what happened to that fortnight?
Indeed.
I've got no idea, but it just disappeared somewhere or other.
Another feeling. Well, they're talking about lightening things up a little bit, but anyway. Yeah, so, I mean, here in Victoria, we're still, as you know, we're still practicing social distancing, which means that we're all spending a lot of time at home. And what better to do while you're at home all the time but watch a lot of television? And so I'm not sure whether you've been doing that, Perry, but I've been doing a little bit of it.
Oh, quite a lot. Catching up on things that my wife and I really should have watched a couple of years ago, and then finally being able to get to the point that there's no live sport on, because as you know, David, I know you're not a live sport fan, but I am. And because there's no live sport at all, It basically gives me enough time to fit in all of that back watching that I need to do. So there's a whole lot that's out there. There's massive amounts of stuff. You could spend your whole day watching this stuff. But
We're spoiled for choice these days. And even if you just restrict it to one genre like science fiction, there's a massive amount of stuff out there.
And also a lot coming up. There's bits and pieces rolling in all the time, which is good for us.
Yeah, indeed it is. Anyway, so today we thought we'd have a bit of a look at some TV series we thought were particularly good. So, as we say, there's a wealth of choice available with a whole variety of such things from Netflix, from Amazon, from Apple. But I thought we'd start by looking at The Expanse, which we've talked about several times on the podcast.
We haven't really gone into it in great detail, though, have we?
No,
we've mentioned it in passing as being one of the great novel series floating around, and the fact that the TV series has been running, but we haven't really got into it.
No, we haven't got into detail. So that's what we're going to do today. We're going to dig in deep. So, as I say, The Expanse has just completed its fourth season on Amazon Prime. Now, attentive listeners may recall that The Expanse series originally launched on the Sci-Fi pay TV channel some years ago, but it was cancelled after season two, presumably, I imagine, because it was just so expensive to produce. I'm not quite sure why they cancelled it, because it was popular even then, I think. But anyway, there was quite a bit of a backlash from the people who liked the series, and there was a petition, and eventually Amazon stepped in, completed season three, which I think they'd started production on season three. Do you know whether that's true or not?
No, I'm not entirely sure of the whole thing. Yeah. I think that this latest one is the first one where they've done the whole lot of it.
Yeah, but, I'm pretty sure season three was scripted. And but Sci-Fi dropped the ball at that point. Anyway, Amazon stepped in, completed season three, and then went on to produce season four, which we've just seen. And they've already agreed to produce season five.
And in fact, I can say that it's only just come out in the last week or so that one of the characters has indicated that prior to the virus lockdown, they had actually completed all of the filming for season five.
Yeah, that's interesting.
So what they will probably do is spend a fair bit of time doing all of the post-production stuff, and there's a hell of a lot of that in this particular television series. And so hopefully we will get it maybe later in the year, maybe early next year.
Well, that'd be great. Sure. Yeah. Well, that's good to know. All right, so I'm just going to do a bit of a background, try to bring people up to speed if they're not familiar with the books, they're not familiar with the TV series. I'm just going to give a bit of a summary, which is not a simple process, let me tell you, because it's a very, very complex plot. So I'll just touch the highlights, as it were. All right. So The Expanse TV series is based on the best-selling books, series of books, which we've talked about, by someone called James S.A. Corey, who isn't a real person, is it? It's actually a pseudonym of the collaborators Daniel Abraham and Ty Frank. What I didn't know until I did a bit of research yesterday was that the whole concept of The Expanse originally arose as a science fiction role-playing game. And in fact, so Ty Frank had put all this together, and he put this immense amount of detail into the background for this role-playing game. And when Daniel Abraham saw this, he was so impressed by the level of detail that had been done that he proposed to collaborate with Frank to turn it into a series of novels, which is what they did. So, okay, so I'm going to give a brief background, but it's not going to be very brief, because, yeah. But it's as brief as I can make it. Okay, I'm not going to go into a heap of detail, way too much. Okay, so the whole concept is that it's a science fiction series. It's set a few hundred years into the future when mankind has colonized a large part of the solar system. Someone's discovered an extremely efficient fusion drive, the Epstein drive, named after its discoverer, which allows travel within the solar system without it taking forever, without it taking years. So Mars and larger asteroids like Ceres and Eros, the moons of Jupiter like Ganymede, all of these have large human communities. But humans being humans, there's a good deal of discord between all these communities. Earth and Mars have had many disagreements over the years and now are hovering close to an outbreak of war. And both have their issues with the people of Ceres, the asteroid belt, and the outer planet moons, this loosely called the belters for the asteroid belt. And also on top of that, we've also got very powerful corporations pushing their own interests, their own agendas. So the initiating incident which drives the story is that we start off with this freight ship, the Canterbury, which is hauling ice from Saturn's rings, to Ceres, I believe, and it picks up a distress call, and they're obliged to go and check it out. And a small group of the ice hauler's crew, led by the executive officer James Holden, are delegated to go and have a look. While they're investigating, the Canterbury is attacked by mysterious spaceships who are using some sort of stealth technology, and they blow up the Canterbury with a nuclear weapon. The crew who were off investigating this other vessel managed to get back to civilization, as it were, with great difficulty eventually, but not before James Holden has caused a stir by broadcasting an accusation that Mars was to blame for the attack. He thinks it's the Martian military that's blown up the ship. And this stirs up considerable trouble throughout the solar system. Anyway, through plot twists too complicated to explain, Holden and his crew eventually end up in possession of a Martian Navy vessel, an attack ship, with all its weaponry on board, which they rename the Rocinante, which, by the way, is the name of Don Quixote's horse. There's obviously a link there. So we eventually discover that the attack on the Canterbury is somehow to do with the discovery of strange alien stuff, which has apparently been sitting on the small moon Phoebe for millions of years. And this stuff, dubbed the proto-molecule, has bizarre properties and is being investigated by one of those big corporations that I mentioned who want to make money out of it, to exploit it. And as part of their plans, they infect the entire population of the asteroid Eros, and very odd things start to happen. So by the time we get to the end of season three, the proto-molecule has diverted Eros into the inner solar system, aimed at the Earth. It's been diverted from crashing into the Earth to instead hit Venus. Has created a strange construction on Venus, which eventually bursts off that planet and zooms to the outer solar system and creates a huge ring, which leads to a series of portals to other stellar systems. And naturally, this is also fought over by all the various factions. A war breaks out between Earth and Mars, but eventually the ring ends up largely under the control of the belters. Now, in all of this, the crew of the Rocinante are deeply involved. So that's the best of a summary I can do for the first three seasons. But I think the interesting thing about it is not just this really interesting background, but the whole series is full of these really interesting characters. There's James Holden and his crew, the belter Naomi Nagata, the Martian pilot Alex Kamel, technician Amos Burton, all of whom have got their interesting backstories and quite interesting characters. And on Earth, we've got Christian Avasarala, who eventually becomes the head of a powerful United Nations, but which is at this stage a world government for the Earth. And then we've come across the Martian Marine, Bobby Draper, the detective Joe Miller from Ceres, who's investigating something strange, and Fred Johnson, who's running the space station Tycho, and his assistant, Carmina Drummer, very interesting individuals, I think, all the way through the series of books, and well cast, I think, mostly through the TV series. And wasn't quite sure about a bit of the casting, but mostly it was extremely very good. So that's my background. Perry, what do you think about the series?
The thing that I like about it is that it's all the whole series. Now we're up to, what, 8 novels, 4 seasons of the television series. It all runs at 3 different levels, which I think is quite good. At the bottom level, you've got the interpersonal relationships. The very first book starts out as a missing person mystery, that Julie Mowell, who is the daughter of one of those corporations that you mentioned, the chairman of one of those corporations, who's one of the richest people in the solar system, goes missing. And Miller is tasked with trying to find her. He doesn't. He's warned off. He resigns. He leaves the police force, but he still wants to try and find her all the way through. And so there's, at that base level, there's that sort of missing person story running all the way right through it. At the next level up, you've got the interplanetary or intersolar system or intra-solar system politics that's running between Earth and the Moon, Mars and the Belters, and then the outer planets. And they're all at loggerheads. So there's 3 different factions that are all going at each other. And so you've got that. And then at a next level up, you've got this proto-molecule that's entered the solar system. And I'm not sure exactly why, though some people have the feeling that it is there to exterminate all organic life. And so you've got 3 different layers of mystery and story and plot going all the way through all of the novels and all of the TV series. And I really think that sets it all up. It really gives you a good sense that you're dealing with a holistic society, a holistic world that these people inhabit. And everything that happens to them at the bottom local level also impacts at each of the other levels above. Yes. And also the top level impacts all the way right down as well. It's very, very well handled, deeply rich in terms of its plot, its story, its characters. And as you say, its characters. There's a large number of characters in this.
I only mentioned a very, very small
handful. Oh, yeah. So there's a large number in the books and also in the film, of course. There's probably bit less in the film because, you know, after a while, it's going to cost you a bloody fortune to get all of these people having named characters, but there's a heck of a lot of them.
Yeah. Well, and I think you've got to acknowledge that the TV series is like any kind of video production of a book. It has to abridge things and cut things down and change things to make it fit. And there's quite a bit of that happening.
At least in this instance, it didn't seem to start off this way in the sense that they did 10 episodes a season, and each season was going to be one book. Mm. I think the first season sort of got into the second book by the end of it.
No, I think actually it's the other way around, because you actually put me onto it, and I watched the first season before I'd read any of the books. And I think the first season actually only gets you about halfway through the first book.
Oh, okay. Well, I misunderstood that. But the it gives you, with 10 episodes of about 45-50 minutes each, so you're talking about 500 minutes. And as we know, the standard run is about one page of a screenplay is going to be 1 minute on film. It's not perfectly accurate, but it gives you a really fairly good idea. So you're talking about 500 pages of screenplay, which is about a novel. And yes, some things are cut. Sometimes it has to be cut because purely and simply the imagination of the novelist is going to be so big that it's going to cost a fortune
in
CGI or everything else to actually realise it out there on film. And so some things are going to be left. But I must admit, the way that the television series, all 4 of them have run, looks wonderful up on the screen. It really does.
No, the production values are really excellent, yeah. And the special effects are very well done. I mean, there are a few things which are almost impossible to do really well, like handle zero gravity or low gravity. It's always tricky, but they kind of get around that. Like on the spacecraft, they've all got these magnetic boots which click to the deck, and that gets you around a lot of problems.
Well, I think that's good. I mean, I think that's an excellent way of doing things. I mean, it secures them to the deck. You don't have to worry about the wavy hand thing about artificial gravity.
No, there isn't
any.
No.
The other thing being an intra-solar system space opera, if you like, in the first instance, is that there's none of this stuff about having to worry about faster than light travel, because that's not there.
No.
Everything has to be done at speeds that people can handle, at accelerations that people can handle.
Yeah, I mean, that's the other good thing about it, is that they actually do show the issues of having to, of what high acceleration, the effects of high acceleration are. And so that was realistic.
You could probably get in there and get stuck into it and say that, oh, they did this wrong and they did that wrong.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's science fiction. It's not reality. But
yeah, true. But basically what it comes down to is those things are pretty minor. I've never watched an episode of it yet where I've gone there and I've got, oh, no, hang on a minute. That's not right. Remember all that stuff we were talking about with Interstellar, where we go, what? What's going on here? None of that. I'm not getting any of that in The Expanse. And I just think it's probably the best science fiction series going around at this time. I think I also mentioned to you at one point that my father, who's been reading SF since the 1940s, says that it's the best science fiction series he's ever read. So he really likes it. He thinks it's quite excellent. And it just carries. And I think it's doing everything it needs to do. And I'm seriously looking forward to the next season. This season four, if you go with the idea that everything is a three acts, you know, you sort of set up the problem, you know, a man gets into trouble, gets chased up a tree. Second act is the people below the tree throw things at him and try and put him under pressure. And the third act is when they try and get off the tree and get away. By God, did they throw a heck of a lot at the poor people that are out on this planet that James Holden's in. I mean, every single time it looks like here's something else that's going to kill him. There's a lot of tension. There's a lot of good stuff in this. People don't stay the same. That's the other thing. I mean, a lot of times if you go back and have a look at the original Star Trek, for example, from the start to finish of the original Star Trek, did James T. Kirk change?
No.
I don't think so. I don't think Spock changed. I don't think any of them did. They had a set personality and they stayed that way. All of the guys that we're dealing, all of the people that we're dealing with here in the main characters are changing over the period of time. They start out in one way and then they have to compromise, or they find there's an extra piece of their character that they can draw on to actually help them solve things. So this is a well-rounded, good production, good acting, good direction, very well-written TV series. And I'd highly recommend this. It's probably about the best thing going around.
Yeah, as Molly Meldrum used to say on Countdown, do yourself a favour.
Go and watch it.
Either read the books or watch the TV series. Preferably both.
I think that's a very excellent idea. I think that you'd not go astray at being able to get this. If you can watch it as it comes out, great. If you have to wait until you get the full box set of the DVDs, I would suggest you do that as well and follow up, because there's probably a lot of extra material in that DVD box set, and you'll be able to watch all that as well. A lot of extra stuff floating around.
Yeah, the making of a documentary would be interesting to watch, I think.
It would be. It's good stuff.
All right, so you've been watching other stuff, I believe.
Yes, I have. Other than that, I've been watching The Outsider. This is a TV series that started earlier this year in January. This has been on Foxtel from HBO. Now, David, you and I discussed the book that this came from, which is in episode 19 in January this year. We discussed the book by Stephen King. We'd both read it. This is a 2018 novel. Now, just as a brief background for those that haven't gone back and listened to that particular episode, this is sort of a semi-sequel to Stephen King's Bill Hodges series, which has been also made into a TV series of three seasons under the title Mr. Mercedes, which was the title of the very first book. It's sort of a sequel in that one of the major characters of the Mr. Mercedes series appears in The Outsider, and that is Holly Gibbons. Now, it's interesting to note that the creator of the TV series The Outsider had not read the Bill Hodges trilogy of books. He'd only read The Outsider, and he had not watched the TV series. because he wanted to do it all on his own. Now, because for whatever reason, they did not cast the same actress for Holly Gibbons in this particular TV series as played the same character in the Mr. Mercedes series, for whatever reason, doesn't matter, but whatever reason, the creator of The Outsider, Richard Price, who worked on a number of TV series over the last 20 years, including The Wire, which is considered one of the better ones floating around ever, he tried to convince Stephen King that they should change the name of Holly Gibbons. And King said no. He insisted that it had to be that particular name. Now, the interesting thing is I've been watching a bit of, every now and again, an interview with King will come up somewhere on YouTube or on a documentary somewhere. And King seems to be really taken with this particular character. Mm. So she was in three Bill Hodges and she's in The Outsider. And although I haven't read it as yet, she is the main character in the title novella in King's latest collection called If It Bleeds, which has only been out for about a month. My bookseller hasn't been able to get that one to me yet because I haven't been able to see him. So I'm sure that he will have that and I'll read that one fairly soon. So King's really quite taken with this particular character. She's somewhere on the Asperger scale, but has very particular interpersonal problems where she has difficulty reading people, but she's able to work out work out solutions to problems based on the data that's presented to her, and she's very good at being able to do that. So we discussed this particular book, what happens at the start of the book and of the TV series, is that it's set in a small town. In the TV series, it's set in Georgia. I got the impression it was set somewhere else in the book, but anyway, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, I think so. Mm.
It's basically classic King territory, small town out in the middle of America, 5, 15, 20,000 people, all of them know pretty much everybody else. And the book and the TV series starts with the very violent death of a young boy. And the killer, and I put that in inverted commas, is seen by four or five people leaving the area covered in blood, getting into a van and driving off. Now, the reason why everybody's being able to see him and recognises him is because he's a well-known man about town. He's the high school baseball coach. He's a teacher at the high school. Everybody knows him. They all know who he is, and they're all able to recognise him really easily. Now, the thing of it is, at the time the murder was committed, this particular teacher who's been accused of the crime was attending a literary conference for teachers some 70 or 80 miles away. So he was nowhere near the scene of the crime, and yet there he is, and his DNA is all over the place. So it seems that we are then moving away from a straight crime into Stephen King territory, where there's going to be a supernatural reason behind this particular crime having occurred. And that's exactly what happens. Now, the book, I think, as we decided, was pretty good. It wasn't one of King's absolute best, but it hits all the points that King does really well. The interactions between the people, the way that the supernatural element is used. And this particular TV series follows that pretty well. It does quite a good job of this all the way right through. Interesting to note that the main character, Ralph Anderson, who is the head cop, who is the one that arrests the teacher, being fully convinced that the teacher is the one that committed the crime because all the evidence points to that, is played by Ben Mendelsohn, who is the Australian actor who's been doing a fair bit of work in science fiction field around the place. He's appeared in a Star Wars film, at least one of those. He's been doing.
He was in Captain Marvel, I had noticed.
Yes, he was, although he was completely unrecognisable because he was completely in prosthetics and you couldn't see his face at all, but you could hear the voice. Mm. He's doing a lot of work over there, and he's one of the executive producers, so that would lead you to believe that him coming on board was one of the reasons why this was able to be made. He does a very good job of moving from a completely sceptical police officer at the beginning over to the stage where he slowly becomes to understand what's going on and accept the fact that there is a supernatural element to this. The TV series doesn't dwell on the violence anything more than it needs to. It's more about the transition of the characters from one particular set point of view over to another one. They handle the interactions really quite well. I thought this was quite a good adaptation of the novel, and I'd recommend it. I gave it about a 4.2 out of 5.
Yeah.
So it's not one of those ones that's going to set the world on fire. It's nowhere near as good as The Expanse, let us say. But it's still damn good. And if you like a bit of suspense, a little bit of horror without the blood and splatter, this is probably not a bad one to have, not okay. a bad one to watch.
That's good. Now, which service is that on?
Oh, I've got that one on Foxtel. So it's an HBO production, 10-part serial. So it's been on Foxtel. Again, it's finished. It's finished now. So I'm thinking that basically it will be available as a DVD down box set probably, well, later on in the year after the virus allows things to be developed and produced and distributed. So have a look for it later on in the year.
Sure, I will do that. All right, moving on. The next one that I wanted to talk about was the series For All Mankind. I have, again, we mentioned this previously a couple of times, several times, I think, on the podcast, but now I want to drill down a bit more. So it's actually quite an interesting background because this TV series was one of the first group that was launched by the new Apple TV Plus service. So Apple seems to be trying to become a player in the new streaming competition, if you like, where we have established services like HBO, Showtime and so on, which I think all started out as suppliers to the cable TV network in the US. And then there's Netflix, which started out, if you remember, by actually mailing DVDs to subscribers. That's how Netflix got its start. And more recently, we've had Amazon and Disney Plus. Disney Plus being the most recent entry, I think. Now, all of these are fighting out for a finite resource, which is viewers' attention time and watching time. Some, like Disney, have got vast existing libraries of content. Others, like Netflix, are now banking on creating lots of original material exclusive to them. So the problem for Apple trying to enter this market was that even with their huge bankroll they could bring to it, they can only start out with a limited amount of original content. So charging a monthly subscription fee for only a handful of material was going to be a big ask. So the strategy they took was twofold. They gave everyone who bought an Apple device a year's free subscription to, you know, like a big ticket device, like a phone or something like that. Give a year's free subscription to anyone who buys one of those, and then make sure that the original content was coming along very rapidly and all of it was well-produced and compelling. That's what they're aiming for. Anyway, that's what Apple did when they launched, was they had two particular series which were particularly lauded. One was The Morning Show, which we've mentioned also here on the podcast a little bit, sometimes called The Morning Wars. And then there's this one, For All Mankind. And the idea of this was so intriguing that I might have actually signed up to Apple TV Plus just to watch it, even if I hadn't just bought a phone and was able to get the first year free. So the concept is an alternate history. It's saying, what would have happened if in 1969 the Russians had unexpectedly beat the Americans to the first moon landing? Wouldn't that create a huge shock to the American psyche, the same way as when the Russians beat the Americans to launching the first satellite in 1957? The same as when they beat the Americans to having the first man in orbit around the Earth. And surely that would have been a bit of a real kick to the Americans and get them really going. And indeed, that's what happens in this. That's the premise here, and that's what the show shows and pulls it off brilliantly, I think. The first thing I think it's worth saying about it is that it works so well because they change real history by just a small amount. So the same president, Richard Nixon, is in the White House. Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin and Michael Collins are all there and ready to go for the unlaunched Apollo 11. Werner von Braun is still in charge of the manned spaceflight program. All these things are as they were in real history. But they introduce some new fictional characters. But even while they do that, they also still follow some of the real people particular Deke Slayton, who is the head of the astronaut office, and he's a continuing character throughout the TV series, and also people like Wernher von Braun. And the creative changes to real history are very subtle and very clever. There's some very clever little bits in there which you could miss if you blinked, as it were. So, for example, there's a bit after the Russians land first, you get a little bit of a recording of Ted Kennedy speaking to someone on the phone or something like that. And he says, "Oh, look, I'm going to rush back to Congress to investigate, you know, why the Russians got there before we did. And I won't bother going to that party at Chappaquiddick that I had planned." And so, of course, he doesn't end up with the terrible accident with the young woman who was drowned when he drove his car off the pier or whatever it was. And so it doesn't destroy his political career the same way as it did in the real world. I thought that was clever. And it was just a tossed-off thing. It's very, very subtle. But there's some more significant ones. But, for example, the series replaces the real crew of the Apollo 10 mission with two of their fictional characters, Edward Baldwin and Gordo Stevens. But it does truthfully show that the landing module of that mission, Apollo 10, which was tasked to come within 10 miles of the lunar surface, it could have landed. And the astronauts really were being tempted to actually ignore the instructions and go down and do it. So in the new timeline, Edward Baldwin is very angry about this, and he spats off to a journalist and gets himself into big trouble. But by doing that, he does succeed in having the question raised by Congress. Is NASA too risk averse? And is that why the Russians keep on beating us? And that in turn leads to the government releasing what they knew about Wernher von Braun's activities during World War II, and then really disgracing him and removing him from his position, and so that they won't be so risk averse. And so then they set NASA on this aggressive path to start building a permanent military base on the moon to counter the Russians. And then the next twist is that the Russians land a woman on the moon, and that prompts the US to think it needs to do the same, initially just for PR reasons. So that then lets the series examine a whole lot of issues to do with gender, and then it goes on to deal with the attitude and treatment of homosexual people. So, for example, one of the new female astronauts, Ellen, is gay, but this must be concealed at all costs lest she lose her place in the program. So we also see the struggles of a young woman called Margot Madison, who has to overcome all this male prejudice and her own sort of reserve to eventually gain a position as a flight director on a par with Jean Kranz. And we also look at all the pressure on astronauts' wives to conform to a rigid standard of behavior. All of this is handled well, I think, and not trivialized. There's some really nice touches, though, like the way we have someone imitating Richard Nixon's voice when he's fulminating about the lack of the American success, doing a very good imitation, I think. And it's just those really nice little touches. And then there are those twists where you think, oh, that would never happen, get real. But in fact, it really could have done. For example, in the show, I'm watching the show, and Deke Slayton, who has been the character throughout, but really was one of the original Mercury astronauts, had been disqualified by having a heart murmur. Anyway, in the show, he gets himself certified to fly in space and becomes an astronaut, in this case, not Apollo 24. And I thought, oh, that wouldn't happen. That couldn't happen. It's true. Deke Slayton did, in fact, fly in space, got himself recertified as an astronaut. And in reality, he flew on the Apollo-Soyuz test program in 1972. So that's really interesting, that sort of stuff happening. And there's a whole lot of really moving human drama in the whole series, particularly to do with Edward Baldwin and his wife and his son. But I don't want to give away too many spoilers, but it's really, really interesting stuff. I think it's a great piece of television. It's really well worth watching. And I'm definitely looking forward to seeing the next season, see where they take it from here. What about you, Perry?
Yeah, I'd agree with all of that. I think that as you say, the subtle differences, it's no big jump from our current timeline over to the one that they depict here. But it's enough, and they slowly start to diverge. And the more you watch it, everything just seems to flow logically from what happens there. Now, sometimes it's not logical in the sense that there's emotions and people are involved and people make decisions where you think, oh, no, that's bloody stupid. Why would you do that? But then you think, well, actually, somebody would have said that and would have actually made that decision. And I think that it comes across very well. I think that it's written very well, acted well. Some of the period sets are wonderful. And it's just interesting to see what things were like back in the 1970s. It's not all that long ago, 50 years ago. But by God, the attitudes of people to others who were slightly different.
Yes.
Was just shocking, absolutely abominable. Oh, and everybody smokes all the time.
Yes.
All the time. That's right. Forget about the fact that all of these guys that were there in the NASA control room with all this equipment around smoking like chimneys. It's just unbelievable.
Yeah,
and then also you look around in that control room and there's one woman, just one. Now, there are the computers, the ones that we've spoken about previously in other books and other films, that is now being depicted, that forgotten history of NASA, where the people that were there as computers, as called computers.
Mm. Who were doing the mission control.
Yeah, who were doing the calculations. Yeah. They were in the background. They are brought up here. You see them. Yeah. But you also see the one woman who's a protege of Werner von Braun gradually working her way up the hierarchy and having to deal with all the male chauvinist crap that she's got gets piled on top of her all the time.
She's a really interesting character.
Yeah. Oh, she really is. And I think that's she's really strong, but she has to hold it together. And she has to basically sacrifice her personal life in order to basically be on one track to be able to do what she wants to do.
Yeah.
Because
she's really bottled up, yeah.
Absolutely, because you can't basically go off and have a personal life because everybody will just concentrate on that rather than treating her like they would treat a male. So it's an interesting examination of societal attitudes at the time, but it's also against a background of, well, for me, this is partly why I got into science fiction, the space race from the 1960s and the 1970s. It just sort of push the imagination along, and this is quite an interesting way of looking at it. They don't actually ever state, I think as we said this once before, they don't actually ever state what the fundamental difference is, what happened to ensure that Russia landed on the moon a month earlier than the Americans. And I speculated that at the time earlier when we spoke about this, that it might well have been the major Russian engineer, the equivalent of Wernher von Braun, in our timeline, died in 1966. If he had survived, chances are this is what would have happened. Mm. And it changes the whole of society because the Cold War just carries on. It just keeps on going. You know, the Americans don't actually, in inverted commas, win the space race. They're just a participant. They win some bits of it. They don't get other bits. The Russians get there first, but they do it all on the smell of an oily rag. And the Americans try to do things a lot safer and have accidents, lots of accidents.
Indeed.
And I think it's very good.
Yeah, it's good stuff, yeah. All right, so what do you got next?
Well, sort of in a similar sort of way, you would have remembered back in the 1960s, already mentioned in this particular podcast episode, the original series of Star Trek.
Now, see, the thing is, that's the only series I've ever seen, the one with William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy. I've never seen any of those. So just give me a very, very brief outline of what the other series were.
Right, okay. Well, this leads into the series that's been shown on, I can't actually tell you which one.
It's on Amazon Prime.
Amazon Prime, the Star Trek Picard. Now, the original Star Trek, just called Star Trek, was 1965 to 1969. Then there was a big gap. Then there were some movies made with the original cast. And then Star Trek The Next Generation ran from 1987 to 1994, about seven seasons.
Now, is that the one with Picard in it?
That's the one with Picard in it. Right. So it's still got the Enterprise. It's number whatever. I'm not a big Star Trek fan. I watch it when it's there. I haven't watched it religiously, tried to track it all the way right through and see the whole lot. There's just too much of it, as I'll explain just in a minute. It just keeps on rolling. But I knew enough about the backstory to be aware of what the premise behind the Star Trek Picard new season was about. Picard is the starship commander for the Enterprise in the Next Generation. So that's where he is. The ones that followed after TNG, the Next Generation, Voyager from 95 to 2001, Enterprise from 2001 to 2005, and then there was another big gap, again with some movies that came in and out all over the place. But then we have a new one, Discovery, which started in 2017, and now Star Trek Picard, which has started this year in 2020. Now, there are a number of pieces from the original series of The Next Generation that had turned up in Star Trek Picard, but there's far too many of them. I'm not a big Star Trek fan, as I said. So what I decided to do, David, to make things a lot easier, was to actually get in contact with a couple of friends of ours who are major Star Trek fans and have a bit of a chat to them about it. Now, I'll introduce them to you before we get started on this. The first one is Ed O'Rourke, who I've known for probably close to 30-odd years. Started working with him in Telstra in IT back in the early 90s and kept in contact with him all the way through. He's a big Star Trek fan. He's not fixated on it, but he's just followed it all the way right through. So he's got some views about all the way right through how this has gone. And the other one is our friend Rose Mitchell. Now, Rose, I couldn't have you in on the conversation with Rose, David. Otherwise, we'd have to change the name of this particular podcast to Three Chairs Talking.
Oh,
because, as you're aware, Rose Mitchell was co-chair with me of the 2010 World Science Fiction Convention.
Indeed.
Now, she also worked on the 99 convention and was a long-term member of Austrek, which is the major Australian science fiction fan club. She was a committee member from 1994 onwards and then was president of it from 1997 to 1999. So she's also was also editor of their newsletter at various times. So she's got a fairly good background about all of the Star Trek universe, which is really quite helpful when you get to this because there's a lot of stuff going on. There's a lot happening. So rather than me basically rattling on about stuff that I really don't know very much about other than the quasi sort of background of it, maybe it's better we just have a talk to Rose and Andrew and find out what they think of it. So, Rose, you first. What were your impressions or what were your thoughts when you first heard that this series of Star Trek Picard was going to be made?
I thought, oh, God, I hope it's not going to be another Discovery. Because that was god awful, but then I became excited, and I thought as more and more recognisable names come on board, you know, Frakes and a couple of behind the scenes guys from the from TNG and DS9, and I also thought, oh, it's going to continue the timeline, not the Kelvin timeline, but the ordinary timeline.
We'll have to get into a bit of how it fits in with the rest of the canon a bit later. But anything else?
No, excited, I think. Excited.
Okay. Andrew, what were your thoughts?
My first reaction was a scream in my head that went, no, don't go there. I was really concerned that it would not work and that B1 and B2 were just going to milk the franchise for all they could get out of it even further.
Mm.
But then when I heard they weren't really involved, I got a little bit more hopeful that it might actually turn out okay.
Yeah, well, I was in two minds. I mean, I'm not a great Star Trek fan. I like it, but I haven't been in a situation where I've adhered to trying to follow the terrible schedules of the Australian television back in the 90s, trying to figure out when and where it was actually being played and in which order. But I thought this one looked sort of pretty interesting, especially when you think of, as you mentioned, Rose, the people that were coming on board to do some of the work. So there was Stewart, for example. I mean, you couldn't have this
you couldn't have this series at all unless Patrick Stewart was going to be involved. And it looked pretty damn stupid if they had somebody else in the role. And then you had Michael Chabon, who's won an Academy Award for Best, not Academy Award, a Hugo Award for Best Novel, and for the Yiddish Policeman's Union, and Akiva Goldsman, who won an Academy Award, an Oscar, for his Best Adapted Screenplay of A Beautiful Mind. So that sort of gave you the impression that there was going to be some quite good material coming through in the back of that. Did that help you, Rose, thinking that it was...
Yeah, so as it became more solid and they were very crafty in the way they released information, so it kept piquing the fans' interest, but it became quite evident that there was going to be some money behind it. And so, therefore, the production values would be really high. And one of the biggest production values is always the script, because let's face it, there's been some pretty crappy science fiction on the telly.
Yeah, it's always generally a case that
very poor scripts.
You can make a poor film out of a good script, but you can really struggle to make a good film out of a poor script.
Precisely.
Really doesn't work at all. So from that perspective, the scripting in behind was going to be good. Did you think, Andrew, that the same sort of thing held for you?
I didn't really hear who was behind it or much about it until it actually premiered. I guess because of my initial reaction, I sort of distanced myself and thought, when it turned up, I'll watch the first one, see how it goes from there. So it didn't really influence me what had gone or who'd worked on it moving into it.
So what did you think of that first episode then, Andrew? How did you think that it kicked off?
It was a slow start, but it was like slipping into comfortable slippers, I think. Picard was playing an old man who was an old man. Stewart was playing an old man.
Because he is an old man, yeah, yep.
Exactly. So, I mean, you're 20 years on and they didn't try to be anything but. I mean, sometimes you get a franchise restart or an attempt and people pretend that there's been no ageing in between, even though the actor's looking rather decrepit, shall we say.
Well, I don't think you can say that Stewart looks decrepit. He still looks pretty damn fit to me. But anyway, I take your point. I think that was quite a good idea to actually set it 20 years after the time, because it gives that sense that Stewart's a bit weary, but there's something eating at him all the way through that is going to get to it. Rose, is that what you felt?
Yeah. So I was going to do the series as a binge, but I couldn't wait. Being a Trekkie, I just had to. I held out for about 6 hours, and then I thought, I've got to do it.
So it was one episode a week for you.
One episode a week, and then up until probably about the fifth, and then I will talk about that part later. But the first episode, boy, it pressed all my buttons. It was. I thought it was the end of it. You know, a little bit teary. I think this is going to be wonderful. And to me, the setup of Picard, he wasn't like he was old and weary. He was bitter. He was jaded. He was angry. There'd obviously been something happened, but we knew what that was because we've all seen the Trek movie that sets the Kelvin timeline. So you knew all about what it was all about. But here he was 20 years on and he was still bitter.
Yeah,
I do like a person who holds a grudge and holds bitterness.
I was also pretty impressed by the production values of this. It actually, I think you can tell very much the difference, even 20 years, okay. But you can tell the difference now in that there's so much effort being put into these 10-episode series that it's like they're basically making a movie every time. The technology has gone through the roof in the last 20 years and the whole thing just looked pretty good. Andrew, if you had that feeling?
Yeah, I think what struck me was that it was very character-driven almost. There was a lack of the typical techno-babble technology solves everything. That wasn't the focus of the story. It was, as Rose said, the story of a bitter old man looking to make right.
Okay, so Rose, what is it that he's trying to make right? How does this actually fit in with the rest of the Star Trek Next Generation? And why is he so bitter?
Right. So I don't think we have to worry about spoilers because everyone will have seen it by now.
No, too late. Don't worry about that.
And it's all over the internet, and most likely people are already doing their PhDs on it. So his bitter is because at the end of it wasn't Insurrection. Which movie was it? Oh, it was the one where Data dies.
Anyway.
That movie, we can fill that in later, is that Picard and co, I don't know who was and co, were trying to rescue the Romulans that were going to be blown up by the supernova or destroyed by the supernova that was actually in the first reboot movie. So, but it was failed to do so because Starfleet refused to provide him the resources. So he wasn't able to launch a rescue mission.
Now, he had pretty much promised them that he was going to do everything that he could, didn't he?
So
in some ways, he actually failed, didn't he?
Yeah, he failed. He failed saving them. But he also, as we learn in future episodes, I think it's in the third or maybe the second or third, is that when he had he was used to being all powerful in Starfleet. I mean, he was the captain of a capital ship, and he was used to being deferred to. And when they told him virtually to bugger off and accepted his resignation, he was completely shocked. And I thought that was a really good scene, that he was completely shocked that they wouldn't take him.
There's that wonderful scene where he goes into the Admiralty and says, I need a ship and I need to head off and I need a crew. And she just sort of looks at him and goes, you're the one that disappeared and walked out? Fuck right off.
she did say it.
So we basically get to the start of this where he's trying to redeem himself and try to fix something that happens. But there's something that sets all this in motion for him, isn't there? There's this this woman turns up and wants to and comes to see him at the beginning of Picard.
Yeah, so that's it turns out after a bit of sleuthing by Picard and snooping about, that it turns out to be one of Data's daughters. So Data's an android, and whilst he was fully functional, he was not able to procreate.
So somehow or other, these two android children, in inverted commas, let's say, of Data have turned up. One of them shows up, and she's killed.
Yes.
And then he decides that he's going off to try and find the other one to determine what's actually going on, because he doesn't believe that these two women know that they're actually androids.
Well, I don't think he doesn't come to that conclusion immediately, but he's also still feeling guilty about Data dying, because Data gave up his life to save Picard at the end of
Nemesis, isn't it?
No, Nemesis, that's it. Brilliant. You get all the points, Andrew.
This isn't Mastermind. You don't actually have to have a situation where you have to be able to answer every single question right at the off. But anyway.
Perry, this is Trek. You're supposed to know this. You're
supposed to know all the ins and outs of all the little bits. But the point is that, so all this sort of sets up, and he's off on his adventure, and he basically then has to get go out and find himself a crew. And then various people start rolling in that were characters in the original or in the Next Generation. Yep. And also somebody turns up from Voyager as well.
Yes. Yeah, and what an interesting character they turned that one into.
This is Seven. Yes, Andrew?
You can't have after Voyager, you can't have Star Trek without Seven of Nine, can you?
Probably not. Now, the actress has not done a huge amount since then, I don't think, although she did appear in a full season of Bosch, which was quite interesting. So she played.
No. She's she was she did quite a few seasons in Law and Order.
Oh, okay. Was there you go. That's not.
Or is it something new? I think it was Law and Order, or it was the other New York Law show.
Anyway, it's one of those ones that I don't watch. So I haven't seen her around. But she did turn up in Bosch, which is where I saw her. And then she's come back into this. And I thought her role had really progressed quite well. It was all tight and bound because she's ex-Borg, of course, in the Next Generations. And then in this one, she's actually, well, she's still got a lot of the implants, but she's basically turned into much more of a human character in this one. Is that your view, Andrew? How did that work for you?
I think the way they introduced the character, gun-toting and shooting the place up, was very apt. And I think they slotted her back in very well. But the whole idea of becoming what they call a ranger, or there was some semi-outlaw group that was metering out justice, seemed to fit with the whole concept of Seven of Nine, I think. I think they dealt the character very well.
Yeah.
She's not the only one that appears. There's also a visit by Picard to a certain planet where he meets up with a couple of others. So he meets up with Riker. Is that right?
And once again, it was good to see Riker was older, grey, fat,
semi-retired, basically, isn't he?
Sedentary, semi-retired, but they didn't try to be anything else. And, yeah, it had been 20 years, they hadn't caught up, and it was actually worked well for me again that Picard could go to Riker and Troy, and there were no questions asked. It was, what do you need?
Did you get the impression?
And it felt natural to me, anyway.
Did you get the impression at any stage that this was sort of like, oh, well, let's think of another character that we can drag out and put in from the previous series just to sort of beef it up a bit? Or did you feel that it all ran along as it should have?
For me, it ran well. But, yes, they were playing a little bit of how can we involve the next character, like Hugh as the Borg. So there was a little bit of nostalgia or nods, and lots and lots of Easter eggs along the way.
Yeah.
But it was deliberate, but I don't think they overplayed the sentimentality.
Yeah, well, I've seen a few articles about all those little Easter eggs that have been popped in from here and there. Rose, did you get the feeling that this really was done as a labour of love with all these extra little bits that were put in?
I thought it was done with a labour of love, and that they weren't just slotting in people because they were available. I thought that there was an overarching story arc. Mind you, I think it went about three eps too long. But there was an overarching story, and these particular characters were key to that story. So Hugh
yep.
was absolutely key. So he was the CEO of the Reclamation Project. He was ex-Borg. And I said he was absolutely key. And the data cameos backwards and forwards, that was all about Picard's conscience and his guilt. And I agree with you guys is that the Troy Riker story, that was absolutely fitting. And I thought that was the planet that had the regenerative values from another one of the movies, because their Riker and Troy's eldest son had died of a degenerative disease that couldn't be cured.
Okay,
so this is I thought it was working really quite well.
So there was a lot of pointers back to the previous series, which I think that the interesting thing I thought about that was that while I didn't recognise a lot of them, I could see that there were things there that I thought, oh, well, that's obviously pointing back to this or pointing back to something else. And I think that you could take this series as being one where it's pitched at two different levels. You can have the sort of general viewer like me who knows a little bit about it, but not a huge amount, and I can still watch it and I can still enjoy it because you get the view, you get enough information from the whole series to give you the idea about what's happened in the past and what Picard's attempting to try and do. But there's also a whole lot of other little bits and pieces that pop up. For the aficionados who know all the intricate details, those mastermind contestants, Rose, who could basically give every single answer, they would actually love this because there's bits and pieces all over the place. And you see it, put it in their head, I've noticed this. Yeah. And I think that shows that there's been a lot of effort put into this to get things together. Andrew?
In fact, I had to laugh. I stumbled across a series of, I think, about 5-minute analysis of every Easter egg in episode 1, episode 2, from people who were very happy that the Easter eggs were there.
Yeah. I mean, I thoroughly enjoyed the Easter eggs, and that was when the story, because the story did bog down, it, just like, you know, in any science fiction 3-book, you know, trilogies, the middle book's always a bit shit and a bit padded. And I just thought episodes five to maybe eight definitely didn't need to be there. Truly, they could have brought it down a bit further, but they sweetened it up with those Easter eggs. And then you go, yes.
So do you think that's where the I mean, every TV series that you see has got a lot of good things about it and a lot of things that didn't quite work. So do you think that, Rose, that the major thing was that it dragged in the middle section?
Yeah, I think it could have been done in 6, maybe 1.5-hour episodes rather than 10.
10 1-hour, Andrew?
I think the pacing was off. It definitely slowed down in the middle. Mm. And I think they tried to rush a bit much at the front. I think looking at it, they could have paced it a bit better. Maybe one episode less time-wise, but, yeah, it still worked, but it was a little bit of a stretch at times.
Well, okay, so if the pacing is a bit of a problem, what do you think actually worked for it? What was good about the overall series?
Oh, I mean, the pacing didn't take a lot away from me, but what was good about the series? It was more Trek, and it wasn't Bannon and Braga. So for me, take any science fiction on TV you can get if it's semi decent. Probably don't analyse the hell out of it. Go with the flow. Sit back and enjoy. And if you don't enjoy it, don't watch it.
So, Rose, what did you think?
I thought what worked well for it was the story arc, the episodic nature of it, because in prior Trek series, it was single stories. Yes. And then the joy of it all was about they had a whole department whose whole job was to do the continuity. Because there'd be nerds like me and Andrew and various other people who would pick it out.
Yeah, you got that wrong.
You got that wrong, yes. It's the wrong fish in Picard's aquarium.
breakfast.
Yeah, and the new series, Picard, harkened back to the old. So it paid homage to it and brought in elements and continued the story. Whereas what's annoyed me about modern Trek, say in the 21st century, is that it's gone back to pre-original series days and I have not enjoyed it. I thought Enterprise was pointless and Discovery, I had, because I'm a completist, I had to watch it, but boy, it was. I had to force myself. It was a struggle.
So you.
I'll have to bring the question then. What's your reaction to the announcement overnight of the next series being about Pike and the Enterprise? The guy who played Pike in Discovery.
Pike. Yeah. I haven't seen that announcement yet because I've been working today. that would probably you've got to go forward. So yeah, it's
fair enough.
Yeah.
Well, maybe what they're going to aim to do.
What's happening at the end of the 24th century? Obviously, according to Picard, it's not going so great. Bit like us here in the beginning of the 21st century, where it's a horrible place to be.
So, do you think that what they're going to be aiming to do for the second series is to try and smooth out some of those problems they had with the earlier series and try and fix it a bit?
Yeah, I think they got the whatever they call them, showrunners, the script writers, are fairly good. They don't seem to be gushing fanboys, unlike Abrams and Orky and co. They've brought a bit of balance and sense to the franchise, I think, but still managed to tell a good story.
Yeah.
So
I think they continue that wherever they go in a second, and I think they've signed a third series.
The third one. All right. So you both look as though, Andrew, you're going to stick with it and see what happens?
Definitely.
Rose?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yes, and I'll be reading up between now and when it's released all the info and the stories and whatever about it. So I'm fully up to speed. Whereas with Discovery, I'm thinking, oh, God, no.
My feelings, exactly.
So you'll be scouring the internet to work out who's going to be guest starring, to be able to work out who's going to come on.
Yeah. Well, they've already said that LeVar Burton's on.
Okay.
So it'll be interesting how they fit him into it.
I believe that.
And Patrick... Whoopi Goldberg going to?
Who? Sorry.
Whoopi Goldberg. Whoopi. Yeah.
That would be interesting.
I believe that Stuart was on one of those midday talk shows. The one that. Oprah Winfrey was on, and he actually surprised her by asking her then, and she had no idea, asking her whether she would be in the next season, and she just about burst out into tears.
Because we never really got Guinan's real full backstory.
Well, and plus she's long-lived, so that's going to be interesting to see how they fit that one in.
Well, the whole point is that they've got themselves set up so that it is quite possible now for them to be able to fix up a lot of those things that went wrong and to close out some of those loose ends, if you like. And from that perspective, I think it's probably going to work well. Andrew?
I know I've had some strong arguments with people who dislike the show for a whole lot of reasons I won't go into. But I think with what we've just talked about and the future episodes... Got the it's like catching up with old friends. I think is the big difference to something like Discovery. And as long as they don't smack those old friends about the face too much, then people are going to be fairly happy.
Yep. Rose, you feel the same?
And much the same actually. Although I'm keen to find out in series two what happens. I want to see more of the Romulan assassin nuns.
Yeah.
Concept.
Okay, all right. Okay, I think from that point, that's probably a good spot for us to finish up. Okay, well, thanks, Rose. Thanks, Andrew.
Thanks for your
insights, for being a lot more involved in the Trek universe than I am, and I'm very much appreciative. So thank you very much for your time this afternoon. Thank you.
Okay, well, that was a good conversation. Thanks to Rose and Andrew for all their background. And hopefully that is enough of an indicator for people to go out and watch it. Because I think even with a minimal amount of knowledge of the Star Trek universe, such as the minimal amount of knowledge that I have, I found it quite enjoyable. And I think that other people probably will as well.
Excellent, excellent. Well, I looked at the first episode, I think, of that, but I haven't pursued it. But I think I will, based on all of that. But as we were saying earlier, there's just so much material that's available, and some of which is very good. And just before we completely wind up, I thought I would just mention a series I've started to watch. I've only seen an episode and a half, but I think it's worth mentioning, which is on Amazon Prime, which is called Tales from the Loop. Now, this is really quite interesting in that it's seems to be set in a small, I think maybe Canadian town. And in this small town, a lot of people in the town work in this underground facility, which is underground beneath the town itself. And this is called The Loop. On the surface, you can actually hear the thrumming and feel like huge engines turning of what's going on below ground. Something's going on below ground. And so a lot of the people in the town seem to work for this. But strange things happen. This facility is by no means something simple. We actually find out through the first episode that there's some really bizarre object down there, science fictional type object down there that's called the Eclipse. And this apparently is causing very strange things to happen. And so it's I'm really intrigued by it so far. And apparently the interesting thing is it's all apparently based on a series of paintings by a Swedish artist called Simon Stålenhag, I think is the name. And you can look at his website and there's some really interesting sort of things. The surface is littered with all these like clunky sort of discarded robots and bits of industrial sort of equipment and little pods and things which are just sort of lying around sort of rusting. And it's interesting. Now, the other thing which has got it going for me is that a lot of the background music is written by Philip Glass, who's a composer I really like. So I'm going to keep pursuing that series and see where it goes. It may peter out into nothing, but so far I'm interested. It's good.
I think there's a fair amount of stuff coming up. It's been pretty popular. And I think we're probably going to need another episode dealing with TV series, science fiction TV series later on in the year, David. Yeah, I think we're going to have to do that.
Indeed.
But looking ahead to next episode, we're going to be talking about the 2020 Hugo nominees, the fiction categories, the novel, novella, novelette, and short story. I haven't quite finished all of it yet, but I'm on track to get through it all by then. I know it's not your plan to finish it all, but...
Well, I'll try and dip in a few of them, yes.
I've given you a few hints as to the ones I'd like you to read so that you can have a bit of a chat about them. Sure. And we'll look forward to that next time.
Indeed. Sounds good. All right. Well, thank you for that, Perry, and we'll see you all. We'll speak to you all in another fortnight's time.
See you then.
Okay. See you then. Okay.
All right.
Bye. Thanks.